So hello and welcome to Media News Podcasts. Media News, as our listeners will know, aims to be an authentic voice bringing you real truthful stories from the Middle East, with a particular focus on the Kurdish question that is often ignored, self-censored or suppressed by the mainstream media platforms. And literally 1 hour ago, the spokesperson for the Syrian Democratic Forces, Farhad Sami, announced finally after 6 or 7 days that the ISIS attack against the Sinar prison in Hasaka was finally over and that the SDF forces were fully in control of the prison. For the last 7 days, I've been watching a feed where the Rojava Information Center have been giving updated information about the situation in the prison. And I'm very pleased and honored today to say that I'm joined by Clara, who has been one of those people at the Rojava Information Center, who has been working for the last 7 days. So welcome, Clara, to Media News.
Hello, thank you very much for having me, Mark.
Hi. Clara, let's begin the interview perhaps by, if you could just give us a little bit of your own story and a little bit of history about the Rojava Information Center. It'd be really interesting.
Sure. So as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm American. And I have been at the Rojava Information Center for about 6 months now. The Rojava Information Center itself was founded in 2019 in response to the war in Afrin, when Turkey invaded Afrin. The international coverage was, we can say that there wasn't so much informed coverage about the situation in general in Rojava, which means west in Kurdish and refers to the western part of Kurdistan split between four nations, which your listeners maybe understand. And there wasn't so much understanding just of the context of the entire conflict in Syria and how Rojava, the Kurdish movement, and then the autonomous grassroots democracy that has grown out of the Kurdish political philosophy in this region, but now includes all ethnic groups in the region, the Assyrians, the Armenians, the Arabs, the Turkmens, the Syriacs. There wasn't so much understanding about that, about the complexity, about the opportunity, about the history of that movement. And the reporting about the war really, really reflected that because Turkey very much sees the project as a threat. And there's so much history that goes into why Turkey was invading Afrin at that time. Why the defense and so many people around the world so vehemently supported Afrin. And so the Rojava Information Center was founded to fill that gap, to help people understand the history of the region, what's going on actually on the ground, how it fits into the larger Syrian conflict. So as an individual, very interested in the project here, very interested in everything that's being accomplished, wanting to learn more myself on the ground, contribute in any way that I can. I'm a former journalist. In many ways, the work that we do at the Rojava Information Center, doing interviews with people on the ground, talking to officials in the autonomous administration about their work. In many ways, it is journalism, but we also try to provide a deeper analysis. I know for myself as a journalist that, you have tough deadlines and it can be really difficult to have enough time to understand things deeply. People do PhDs on things, right? And journalists only have maybe a few days. So the Rojava Information Center tries to help do that legwork a little bit, break it down, translate. What's happening here is very different than what's happening in a lot of places in the world, right? It's a it's an anti-state project. And what does that mean, right? Like, what does that mean? It's a translation of ideas, languages, ideas, everything. So we try to fill that gap ideologically for people. And then also, we just try to give reliable facts and figures about what's happening on the ground so that people can have transparent understanding of the situation.
Well, I've watched you do that over the last week, and I have to say it's been incredibly impressive to watch. And you should feel very proud of yourself, you know, for doing that. It's, as you say, that particular part of the world is subjected to such misinformation and sort of psychological warfare from so many different parts. It's so important to get verified information in the professional way that you guys all work. It's just been incredible. So on that, you know, many people around the world would have thought that ISIS had been defeated in 2019 when they were defeated at Baghouz. And from Baghouz, many thousands of ISIS fighters and prisoners were taken to different prisons in the northeast of Syria. And there has been this continuing discussion and about what to do with these prisoners. And then suddenly last Thursday, seemingly out of nowhere, there was an attack on a prison in Hasaka, which turned into quite an armed conflict. And so this was like being reported as the most serious military attack by ISIS since 2019. Did it just come out of anywhere, or was there anything preceding this attack that would give clues as to the potential attack?
So one of the things that we do as the Rojava Information Center is we publish a monthly sleeper cell report about the ISIS sleeper cell attacks in northeast Syria. And so our area of coverage for that report is just the area that's controlled by the SDF and administered by the Autonomous Administration. But we also keep our eye on what's going on around Syria in general. And so we can say that actually over the past year, ISIS sleeper cell attacks within NES went down. And quite significantly, they started going down exactly 6 months ago, which, as the SDF has now told us, one of the ISIS prisoners they captured as a part of the attack has said that exactly 6 months ago, ISIS began planning this larger scale attack. And so intelligence agencies had their eye on this, right? The US Department of Intelligence in their September report did share that they were not celebrating about the drops of ISIS attacks, but they saw it as a cause for concern, which has, you know, borne fruit, unfortunately, as a concern. So they saw it as a cause for concern, and they were feeling that maybe ISIS was taking time to consolidate outside of SDF territory in the Badia Desert. And we saw directly outside of ISIS, of SDF territory, ISIS in the past few months, starting in October, begin to launch kind of larger, more military-esque attacks against Iranian militias, against Syrian government outposts. And it, you know, it's quite possible that that was indicative of them starting to sort of redevelop their military chops or maybe practice in preparation for this attack. So we definitely did see some things. And then additionally, the internal counterterrorism forces, the HOT of the Autonomous Administration, actually did raids in November and December, which uncovered a very similar plot. And they actually captured the man who claimed he was responsible for planning it in December, on Christmas, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, the security forces here were on high alert, right? The coalition was aware of this.
So some of my friends on the editorial team at Media News, when I said I was going to interview you and I asked them for some questions that they would like to ask, one of our friends said, who do you think supported ISIS in these attacks? We have done a few reports about, actually I did an interview with Sally Muslim a couple of nights ago, and he was saying that there was this guy that probably you mentioned just now that was arrested in December with a cell of about 11 ISIS people. And they were collecting intelligence from them, and they were sort of confirming that they were getting support from Turkey and the areas controlled by Turkey in Serikaniye, Girispe and Afrin and such places. Is that what you're hearing as well?
Sure. I mean, you know, this is, of course, a delicate question. Turkey is a NATO member. People are not really used to thinking about Turkey in this way. But Turkish, let's say, tolerance of ISIS is not a new phenomena, right, at the very least. So starting at the very beginning of the ISIS crisis, we can say, in Syria, you know, Turkish border guards were notorious for looking the other way as foreign volunteers streamed into Turkey across the Turkish border. And we see in the Syrian National Army groups, which is sort of a patchwork of militias that have been made up by some of the Syrian opposition groups and then backed and sort of organized into this structure by Turkey. Certainly participation in those groups and participation in the leadership of the militias and the leadership of the Turkish occupation authorities within their occupied zones within Syrian territory. Former ISIS membership does not seem to be disqualifying for participation in those groups. And so, for example, we saw that just 2 weeks ago, a former ISIS emir who is now in a different militia that makes up part of the SNA was made the police chief of Serikaniye, one of the major cities in the occupied zones, by the Turkish military officials who are there. So, and then, of course, we've now learned during the course of this operation that many of the ISIS attackers who came from outside the prison came from Serikaniye in addition to other places. So, you know, it's a difficult thing. People aren't used to thinking of it in that way, but you know, there just seems to be more and more evidence, if not direct planning, extreme tolerance, let's say.
Okay, Clara, maybe you could take us through the last sort of 6 days as you've witnessed it, albeit, you know, from a little bit further away. But I mean, you weren't directly there. Presumably you're in a city close to Hasakah. Could you take us through sort of as far as you know how it went? Because you've been getting information directly, and what generally happened?
Sure. So at the very beginning on January 20th in the evening, there were two explosions, later proven to be suicide bombers, directly outside the prison. From there was a lot of commotion. It seems that the attack was coordinated by attackers outside and those within the prison. And so immediately after the bombs went out, prisoners rioted, began burning things in their cells, and seized a cache of weapons in addition to, right. And so from there, you know, the situation was very chaotic. It was clearly very coordinated. There were caches of weapons outside in sleeper cell houses in the neighborhood surrounding. And the SAH and the SDF very quickly surrounded the prison and created a partial military security zone. But because ISIS was also coming from outside, they were fighting on two fronts, both from inside and from outside. And the situation was very chaotic. Originally, the ISIS attackers who attacked the prison from the outside were dispersed into the surrounding neighborhoods and broke into civilian houses and started using those apartments and houses as their basis of operation. And there were intermittent clashes. And those inside the prison were shooting outwards. You know, eventually coalition support came in, coalition air support, and also support from on the ground troops and Bradley IFVs, heavy machine guns, and elimination flares from the coalition. And so that happened immediately on the first evening. Over the next few days, the situation stayed in this way, with SDF and SAH forces making slow gains, but their approach was really stunted by the fact, which became clear on about the third day to everybody, that there were about at least 650, you can say 700 miners also housed in the prison facility in the area that ISIS had control over. And the Ferhad Shami, the spokesman of the SDF, now that the battle is over, has said very clearly that they could have used very heavy weapons and machinery and finished the operation within 2 days maybe, but they were going very slowly with their approach and trying to be as cautious as possible, of course, to protect life as much as possible for these boys. So it's a very tough situation, but obviously we can say that this was likely strategic on the part of those who planned the attack, and it's unconscionable. And we will see in the coming days how many injuries, potentially fatalities, there were among the minor population, and then of course the prisoners who were not a part of the uprising, who maybe got caught up in everything, and it's a tragic human cost.
Absolutely. And I mean, it really is quite, I think for many people, I would have expected to see it sort of broadcast headlines around the world. ISIS reappears in Syria, shock, horror. And, you know, if it was in any other circumstances, you would probably expect to see sort of countries making statements of support and diplomatic messages of support to fighting ISIS, and the international media giving it blanket coverage, I would have expected. But what has been your experience in terms of the international media and the way that they have reported it?
Yeah, I mean, so I've been really heads down, sort of looking inwards, and I haven't really come up for air yet to see outwards, to really take stock of how the coverage has been. But of course, I know, you know, we're one of the sources who are really on the ground, speak fluent English, we can serve as an intermediary. And so I feel like I have a pretty good sense of how much interest around the world there was. You know, we got requests from all the top news agencies in the world. And, you know, it wasn't nothing, but it certainly, it was short of an onslaught, let's say. I was happy that most of the top news agencies, somebody from them was reaching out. It seemed like there was at least one or two articles. But you know, what I would really hope to see is some more analysis. So a lot of the coverage that I saw was really like, okay, there's a battle going on. This is like top news right now, sort of breaking news, let's say. But what I really hope we see, and I'm, you know, we'll see in the coming days and weeks, is some analysis of, oh yeah, right, this is still a problem, right? Like the autonomous administration, the SDF, needs international support. There are thousands of international fighters, former ISIS fighters, and who were turned into, back again this week, into active fighters who are in SDF territory. And there's very little support being given for rehabilitation, housing, security. And for example, the prison that they were housed in was not custom built for this purpose. It was retrofitted dormitories. It had been used as military housing for many years, but it was originally built as dormitories for the university. And you know, the SDF had long warned that the security wasn't up to par necessarily for a non-custom built facility for prisoners, you know, of this danger level. But there's very little resources here, right? So they need to work with what they have. They do work with what they have. But this is a global problem. I mean, so one other thing I want to say on that point is just, we've gotten a lot of we've gotten a lot of interest from the international media about the repatriation of foreign nationals, and it's good they are paying attention to that, trying to keep pressure on foreign governments to help take the burden off the SDF and the AANES. At least they can, you know, only have the locals to help and deal with. But it's important that we don't just think about getting, you know, the Australian boy or the American boy or the Canadian boy, you know, as precious as they are and as important as they are. We also think about the Syrian boy and the Iraqi boy and the Kurdish boy, and how we can get them secure housing, we can get them rehabilitation, education, to really solve this problem generationally, you know, and not just in the moment. So
Sally Muslim again mentioned that in December of last year, there was this conference at Astana in Kazakhstan, the Astana sort of meeting between Turkey, Iran, Russia, who are obviously representing Syria. And he seemed to think that all these attacks and plans began, you know, to happen after the Astana meeting. And he thinks perhaps that this is a sort of a plan that is being implemented between Turkey, Russia, and Iran. What's your comments on that?
Well, I think certainly one of the problems that the autonomous administration has is that it's not recognized internationally, right? It doesn't have the legitimacy that other state actors do in order to move in the political and military world. And part of the reason that is because states like Iran and Russia, I mean, of course, see this as a threatening project. It's based on democratic principles. It's trying to encourage the people to be involved in their own self-governance, people of all ethnicities to be able to self-determine, to provide for their own defense. The SDF is made up of militias of all ethnic groups, but of course, they're not they're not exclusively one ethnic group, right? So I've met Kurds who serve in the Assyrian militias, male and female. You know, I've met plenty of Arabs who serve in the primarily Kurdish militias, YPG and YPJ. You know, so this is not, it's just about allowing people self-determination. And this is something that, of course, is threatening to a country like Iran or Russia, right? And so one thing that the international community and those of conscience around the world who are interested in the project that's going on here, and of course it's not perfect, it's evolving, it's growing, right? But it has a potential to bloom, to be a bloom from the ashes of a terrible conflict, we can say, right? And those of us, I'll put myself in that category truly, and you know, those of us in of good conscience around the world, like one thing we could do is to try to help the autonomous administration be able to step onto the same playing field as the larger state players, right? So pressure governments to recognize the autonomous administration, right?
Yes, of course, to recognize the autonomous administration, and as you said earlier, to recognize and take responsibility for some of these foreign fighters who. There was a human rights worker from the United Nations the other day said that there are ISIS prisoners from 54 different countries in these prisons in AANES. And now, obviously, with this prison in such a state, it's only, I mean, if things were bad before this ISIS attack and now the prison has been totally destroyed, I mean, it's just like unthinkable about, you know, what the situation is going to be now. And like, as you say, international, you know, it's all very well to say, oh, the Kurds are great fighters and they've defeated ISIS and let's make films and photographic exhibitions about them. But what about some political recognition? What about support and help and resources to help build these prisons, for more secure prisons for these ISIS prisoners, and to help with rehabilitation of the ISIS prisoners. So I mean, Clara, you are doing more than most to support that project. And I would like to thank you on behalf of listeners to Media News, you know, for all the work that you have been doing in your 6 months there, and your fantastic work that you've been doing just over the last 7 days in providing these verifiable and, you know, verified facts for the international media. So thank you so much for that. And it's been a real pleasure talking to you. And if there's anything else you'd like to say, just in summary, please do.
Thank you very much, Mark. Yeah, it's been a pleasure. I mean, thank you very much for your support. It's always good to know that what we do is helping. And I would encourage any listeners to go to our website, RojavaInformationCenter.com. We have many reports about the system here. One particular report that might be interesting in the context of this battle is you can look up anti-terror trial system in Northeast Syria. We did a very extensive interview about a year ago with a public defender at the People's Court in Komishlo. Here, just about how the system works, the challenges that they face in making sure that everybody has representation, and the lack of resources, but also, you know, the humanitarian approach that the courts here are trying to take. Then one final thing I would add is just that the system here serves as a beautiful counterbalance to ISIS's ideology, right? So part of the reason why there's so many ISIS prisoners here is because the autonomous administration is governed by a social contract that outlaws capital punishment, because it's based on a deep respect for human life and human rights. And that's something that the international community should be talking about, paying attention to, and I believe supporting.
Thank you so much, Clara, from the Rojava Information Center over there in the Autonomous Administration of Northeast Syria. Thanks so much for talking to us, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
Great. Thank you very much, Mark. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.